Welcome to the second afternoon session of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. To my left is Justice McCoy, and to my right is Justice Walker, and I'm Justice Gardner, and we are your panel for this afternoon. We have one case left on the docket for oral argument, and if you're ready, I'll ask Megan to call the case.
The court will now call in the interest of BGD, AJD, and JBD minor children. Thomas Michelle will argue for appellant, and Mr. Stephen Orsinger will argue for appellee.
Okay, Mr. Michelle, are you ready to go forward?
I am, Your Honor. Okay. May it please the court. I'm Thomas Michelle, and I have the privilege of representing Mr. Ricky Durzoff. As the court is familiar, this case has once proceeded to the Texas Supreme Court. We are here again a second time after a final trial before the court. I would like to draw, before I begin, draw the court's attention that the Supreme Court, I don't know if the court is aware, recently handed down an opinion on Friday, the In re Scheller case. I've provided copies to appellate counsel, and I've also provided four copies for the court. That is a case that extensively discusses and relies on this case for its standards set forth by the Texas Supreme Court, the In re Ricky Durzoff case. In that case, similar to this case, the mother had passed away. The grandparents came in and contended there was a significant impairment of the emotional well-being. Specifically in that case, which even stronger than in this case, they try to present specific objectively manifested ailments. The girls were displaying anger. One of the girls was experiencing isolated bedwetting and nightmares. The witnesses who had seen the Pemberton children testified from their experience denying access would impair the children's physical or emotional well-being, and the significant impact of loss of maternal family members of the girls leaving Pemberton, the only remaining maternal family connection. The court then stated on page 2, after that quotation under asterisk 3, quote, however, that evidence is not enough to satisfy Pemberton's hefty statutory burden, and we hold that the trial court abused its discretion in issuing a temporary order for access to and possession of the children. Like the children in Durzoff, there is nothing in the record here to indicate anything more substantial than the children's understandable sadness resulting from losing a family member and, according to the Pembertons, missing their grandparents. The court held that that was insufficient to overcome the burden, and the trial court abused its discretion. We believe the trial court erred in entering its order because the Texas Supreme Court previously ruled with facts virtually identical, if not even stronger, to Ricky Durzoff's position, so it would not amount to a change, and the law of the case would still apply.
Well, has there been a change in the facts since the Supreme Court decided this case?
I think if there are any changes...
The Durzoff case, not the Scheller case.
Yes, I think, if anything, the only changes in the circumstances are more favorable, so any application of the law of the case would still apply. The objective evidence... And that's one of the keys I'm trying to focus on, which the Supreme Court tried to elicit, is objectively manifested evidence that you can try to see some objective evidence. The only evidence, they've been in litigation for 7 years with the Johnsons, Ricky Durzoff, since 2003. The evidence by Dr. Otis, the court-appointed expert in this case, testified as to the objective aspects were that they were doing fine. The children were excelling at school. They had friends. They were succeeding well, looked like outgoing, happy children. In contrast, Dr. Otis, well, what would you expect to see? Some depression. He said you would expect to see some evidence of something like, this is found at page volume 2, 163, something to show depression, not even a significant impairment, but just let alone a more narrow, which the Supreme Court has held is not enough if a child suffers depression. You would expect to see something like loss of appetite, weight loss, loss of energy, loss of ability to function practically on a day-to-day basis, or lethargy. All of those were testified to Dr. Otis. None of that evidence is here. And in fact, the reason, Justice Walker, the only evidence we see in the record is that the kids are doing better. The only time was in 2003, after the mother had passed away. They went to counseling and were on antidepressants. That, from reading the briefs and the case history of the Supreme Court, you'll see that at that point, Ricky Durzoff, because of the actions of the grandmother, were so debilitating, cut off access at that time with the approval of Dr. Otis. At that time, the children began to heal. They came off the antidepressants. The counselor released them from counseling. They returned to school. Every aspect of their life started to return to normal when this father, suffering a dramatic loss of his loving wife, recovered and reunited the family. That's the last thing in the record, Your Honor. And that's before the first time the case went up on appeal. When the case went up on appeal to the Supreme Court, those facts were already established in record. Dr. Otis comes back and does even a less, and I contend a insufficient analysis. He meets with the children two times in a three-year period. He does not check their medical records. He does not check the school records. He doesn't check with the numerous collaterals that he should have done. He testified that his testing from 2005 was too stale to use. Question before the court is, how on earth, when the Supreme Court directly said Dr. Otis's testimony as to the conditions of the children was legally insufficient to meet the heavy threshold, how in 3 years, with every example of them doing well, could possibly change that result? We contend it's not. It can't. This judge came back and entered the exact same order that he got reversed on the first time. Dr. Otis testified at the first time. Dr. Otis testified at the second trial.
The second time, he did say that, in his opinion, they were suffering from significant, they would suffer from significant emotional harm.
We say no, okay. And I'll tell why. Absolutely not as to the younger girl. Very clear in the record. We tried to point that out in the briefs. It doesn't even come close to Jenna. He says she's fine. The only child I think is even conceivably before the court is the boy, Andrew. Jenna's doing great. He says, and I asked the court to review the record in the appellee's cites to what they contend happened and what the actual testimony is. So if you go back and compare those records and what those cites and what they say, they argue that he reaches that conclusion of possibly saying that Andrew will suffer a significant impairment. But noticeably, this gets to another legal issue, Justice Gardner, is the evidence is not to Connie. It suffers the exact same legally deficient problems from the first case and the second case. The Supreme Court gave him a roadmap. You didn't have, and it's quoted in the opinion at 233. You say there's some harm as to being denied to all of the Johnsons, the uncles and extended family members, but you don't have any evidence as to Connie. Dr. Otis, on page 51 of the reporter's record, is questioned directly and by Ricky's trial counsel as he's going into about talking about just Connie. Question, line 20. And what I'm talking about as far as separating it, maybe as a matter of degrees, you can't isolate Connie and say this significant impairment is going to happen just because of denial of visitation with Connie. Answer, line 25, that's correct. Importantly, Dr. Otis in his report did not say denial of visitation to Connie would result in a significant impairment of emotional harm. They had their roadmap. They could try to train Dr. Otis to use the magic words, significant impairment, and even then he was willing not to say, I'm not even going to tie it to Connie, as opposed to the entire Johnson outfit, which was specifically rejected in Durzoff 1. I've cited in the court's opinion another legal deficiency. There was no denial of visitation. That's undisputed. Not only that, I believe the appellee wants to set a new standard to adopt their position. They're going to tend, well, the statute reads prospectively, not in the past. If this court were to adopt that standard, this court would be granting standing to every grandparent to bring a case if there's been no denial of visitation. That means, I think in the future, Dad's going to deny me some visitation so I can come on in. And as this court's aware, that opening gate threshold, as Justice Kennedy wrote in his concurrence in Troxell, is one of those battles that has to be fought, because once grandparents get their foot in the door, they can be there to stay for the remainder of the age of the children. Let's look at Connie and how devastating this alleged denial is, which there's no denial. And on top of it, tell the court, we've cited this both in our opening brief and our reply brief, they still can't point in the record a single instance where Connie even bothered to ask to see the children and that it was denied. I think they want this court to adopt yet a new standard to say, parent, not only do you can't deny it, you have to affirmatively go out and offer visitation. So you start scheduling, contacting the parent and saying, oh, I've got this obligation that you've got to go out and start having visitation. Connie asked for one visitation. It was agreed to by Connie. He rescheduled the time, but it was done. Let's look at Connie. Andrew. Connie's not even in Andrew's core group. Dr. Otis reported that. How could there be a significant impairment of emotional development when somebody's not even in their core group? Jenna, the little pistol, Daddy's little girl, has everybody in her core group. There's no evidence on Jenna at all. Dr. Otis doesn't talk to Jenna about her significant impairment at all. We brought it up in our opening brief. We expected to see possibly some citation. It's not in the record. It's not in his report. Then they want to start shaving off the edges. They say, well, you know, these visitations they gave, they were, quote, sham visits. I don't know how you can have a sham visit. I think you either have a visit or you don't have a visit. And they also contend that they have a right, although no case supporting it, that they have a right to unsupervised visitation. So the fact that a grandparent were to see a grandchild at Christmas, because Dad's there, that doesn't constitute a visit. The Austin Court of Appeals in Svoboda expressly rejected that contention as well. Dr. Otis's report, both sides spend a lot of time attacking Dr. Otis's report, and they spend a great deal of time trying to support Dr. Otis's report. And I will tell you, I've read this record a number of times trying to glean what Dr. Otis was trying to say, because remember, in his report, he doesn't ever say significant impairment of emotional harm. It's only until it's spoon-fed to him by opposing counsel, say these magic words. He seems to say or hold that Andrew could possibly suffer a significant impairment of emotional harm because visitation's been cut off. Well, visitation hasn't been cut off. It's a faulty premise. Under Doe-Bear, Robinson, Gamble, there's an analytical gap because his premise is fatally flawed. He seems to be under the impression that they're not having visitations. And for the variety of reasons we set forth as to why we thought Dr. Otis's opinions were constituted no evidence, to the extent they even get there. A lot of the record sites, for example, they say Andrew was upset, and they say Andrew is potentially vulnerable. That's at 2RR89. That's a nice, almost, I think, meaningless phrase. I think we're all potentially vulnerable. 2RR89, reporter's record, 82, could possibly affect his feelings. At Reporters Record 3169, if Andrew develops depression, it could negatively affect him. Well, I think anybody who gets depression, it could possibly negatively. None of the testimony goes to the standards. The closest they get is after we broke at the first trial, and there was a hearing to see if Dr. Otis could even testify as to the denial. They get in out of the blocks, get a question to Dr. Otis about significantly impairing. He answers yes. Upon cross-examination, asked to Andrew, can you specify simply straight out as to Connie? The answer was no. There's been no denial. There's nothing tying it to Connie. The Supreme Court has previously ruled. I'll finish up on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Orsinger, and I represent the appellee, Connie Johnson. There are two fundamental issues in this appeal. First, does Mr. Dursaf intend to deny Mrs. Johnson access to her grandchildren in the future? And second, would that denial of access significantly impair their emotional well-being in the future? These are the two statutory standards. They're what Mrs. Johnson was required to show by a preponderance of the evidence, and they're what the trial court determined that she did show. Now, at trial, Mr. Dursaf claimed that he didn't intend to deny access to Mrs. Johnson and that the children wouldn't suffer any emotional harm. However, the trial court determined that Mr. Dursaf was not credible and that based on the totality of the remaining competent evidence, including expert witness testimony from Dr. Otis, Mrs. Johnson fulfilled her statutory burden. Our position in this appeal is simply stated. The trial court exercised its exclusive prerogative to resolve conflicts in the evidence, and its judgment was not contrary to the overwhelming weight of that evidence, was not clearly wrong, and was not unjust. That's what Mr. Dursaf has to show to succeed in the factual sufficiency component of his challenge, and that's exactly what he's failed to do. Now, one of the central themes in Mr. Dursaf's brief, and again here on oral argument, is that, quote, virtually nothing has changed since the time of the temporary orders that the Supreme Court mandamused in Ray Dursaf. This is the cornerstone of many of his arguments, including the law of the case doctrine and the insufficiency of the evidence of significant impairment. However, this claim is not accurate. Virtually the entire case has changed since then. Before, during In re Dursaf, the evidence only showed a lingering sadness with the kids, and Dr. Otis admitted that there was no significant impairment. Now we have evidence of hopelessness and despair, grief and anger, intense distress, and potential depression. Before, the evidence showed that Mrs. Johnson had issues controlling her impulses, but now the evidence shows that she's succeeded in eradicating some of the alienating behaviors that she had, and even the children recognize this. And before, there was no specific testimony that it was probable that denying access to Mrs. Johnson would cause significant emotional harm, but contrary to what Mr. Dursaf claims now in oral argument, there is direct and positive testimony that such a harm would occur. From the record, Dr. Otis testified, quote, there is a high risk that Andrew's well-being will be significantly impaired if visitation isn't resumed. That's Reporters Record, Volume 4, pages 54 through 55. Now, while this risk is not as definite with Jenna as it is with Andrew, Dr. Otis did conclude that there still is some risk with regards to Jenna's significant impairment. Mr. Dursaf's second central theme is that there's no evidence that he intends to deny access to the kids. However, we need look no further than his own statements of his intent to find that evidence. Mr. Dursaf testified under oath during his deposition in another case that if it were up to him, Connie wouldn't see the children at all. Mrs. Dursaf also told Dr. Otis that he has no plans to continue the visitation with Connie. That's at Reporters Record, Volume 4, page 65, and on his report twice on page 1 and 3. Now, Mr. Dursaf's position, though, is that allowing the children to participate in extracurricular activities, ones that he can't bar Mrs. Johnson from attending, shows that he doesn't intend to deny them access in the future. But The trial court didn't believe him. The trial court found that, Mr. Dursav had orchestrated these sham visits that we've heard about during the litigation to make it appear as if he would permit visitation in the future.
How did he do that? How was it sham?
Well, I think the trial court found that it was a sham because those visits were always in close proximity to either a hearing that was going to be held in the case or an evaluation that was going to be conducted by Dr. Otis. And the sham in that, I assume, is that it wasn't done in good faith. It wasn't done because he felt like the grandparents needed access to the kids, but it was instead done to say to the court, look, I'm giving them access. They can have access anytime they want. I'm not denying their access. And the proximity of those visits, those sham visits, to those hearings and the evaluations was what I imagine the court used to determine that they were sham.
So but as a result, is it your position that, or their position, that Connie's position, that visitation was cut off or access was cut off?
Our position is that that question is irrelevant, whether or not visitation had been cut off. The question under the statute is whether visitation will be cut off. And that
I'm sitting here looking at the statute, and 153.433 A.D. says the court may order reasonable possession of or access to a grandchild by a grandparent if the grandparent requesting possession of or access to the child is a parent of a parent of the child, and that the parent of the child, does not have actual access to the child.
The statute that we're using is 153.433 B, I think it is. I can read it out to you, the section that this suit is based on. If you give me just a second. The statute that we're relying on is the court may order reasonable possession of or access to the grandchild by a grandparent if the grandparent proves by a preponderance of the evidence that denial of possession of or access to the child would significantly impair the child's physical health or emotional well-being.
Okay.
So,
and are there cases that support your position that this can be prospective only?
Yes, I believe there are. I believe Mays Hooper actually supports that position. Mays Hooper and JMT. In Re JMT, which is a case that Mr. Dursav cites in his brief, the court stated that the evidence indicated that the appellants would continue to permit appellees to have access to the child. Now, what happened in JMT was that they overturned a temporary order that was granting access to the grandparents, and the reason they did so was because there was no evidence of significant impairment and no evidence of a denial of access. And the way that they phrased that, the way that they demonstrated that there was no evidence of a complete denial of access, was by saying the evidence indicates that appellants would continue to permit appellees to have access to the child. So I think that that indicates, at least from a case law perspective, that the denial of access has to be prospective. But there are other reasons, too. There are kind of logical reasons why the denial of access should be prospective. One of them is that the significant impairment, I think undisputedly, has to be in the future. That's why the legislature used the term would. If they hadn't intended for the significant impairment to occur in the future, then they would have phrased the statute that the denial of access had significantly impaired, not would significantly impair. Now,
I noticed a minute ago when you were talking about Andrew, you went to the record and gave us a record site.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went to the girl, you didn't. Would you like to go to the girl?
Sure, I can give you some record sites on Jenna.
We were talking about Dr. Otis's testimony.
Right. There's in Reporter's Record, Volume 4, page 59, Dr. Otis testified that if only one of the children were able to visit Connie, it would be hurtful, sad, and disappointing experience for the other child. He was talking in the event that the trial court ordered access with regards to Andrew and not Jenna. Would that significantly impair her emotional well-being? A lot of the statements that he makes, he...
But that's not exactly a lack of access to the grandparents. That's what the effect of another child doing something would have.
Right.
Not lack of access to the grandparents.
Okay. I can read you something more direct then.
Okay.
From Reporter's Record, Volume 4, page 14, this is a question-answer between Connie's trial counsel and Dr. Otis. Question, do you believe that if she, that's Jenna, is denied visitation with Connie Johnson, there we have a specifically tied to Connie, her emotional well-being could be significantly impaired? Answer from Dr. Otis. I think there's some probability of that, but much less so than Andrew. I don't see her at the same degree of risk as Andrew. Question, so Andrew is at a far higher risk? Answer, I think so, yes. Question.
What, as an expert, what is his threshold? More likely than not, by preponderance, clear convincing.
Yeah, I mean,
this wouldn't reach a medical malpractice or negligence or any other standard.
Agreed. Excuse me. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I think that is kind of an unresolved issue out there in the case law. Is that there really isn't a definition of what significant impairment is and whether a risk of this of despair and hopelessness and anger and depression, you know, whether that actually, you know, rises to the level of significant impairment. I think that it obviously does, but there's no case law out there that tells you that.
Does that overcome the presumption?
Here's what I would say. I would say that with regards to what Dr. Otis found specifically for Andrew, this hopelessness and despair and the grief and anger, all those things, that would rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence. But what we're looking for here is not a clear and convincing evidence standard, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. And so by saying that there is still a risk with regards to Jenna, even though it's not as high as it is with Andrew, that there still is a risk that she would be significantly impaired if there were a denial of access. And I think that meets the preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I have a question. Since you're basing your case on the claim that there's going to be a future denial of access and a future substantial impairment, isn't that the same future denial of access and the same future substantial impairment that was decided by the Supreme Court against you?
No, the evidence has completely changed. That was one of the themes of Mr. Dursaff's brief, was that nothing's changed, but virtually the entire case has changed. We have a four-day final trial. We've had an updated report by Dr. Otis. We've had testimony from all kinds of collateral witnesses. We've had Mr. Dursaff testifying in his deposition in that other case that he intended to cut off access. We have several facts now that weren't before the trial court when it issued its temporary orders and weren't before the Supreme Court during
In
re Dursaff.
None of the facts that you mentioned go to substantial impairment.
The hopelessness and despair and the grief and anger is not a significant impairment of emotional distress?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you say that.
Yes, that's what our contention is, that those emotions that the children are feeling and that Dr. Otis said they would feel in the future are the evidence of significant impairment. There's other evidence from other sources as well, but Dr. Otis is the main one.
What other?
Well, there's evidence from Mrs. Johnson. There's evidence that we have from looking at what happened in the past with the one child who's now been emancipated. There are two children that are the subject of the suit now, but when it was filed, there were three. His name is Gage, and following the mandamus in the Supreme Court, his relationship with Mr. Dursaff deteriorated to such an extent that he moved out of Mr. Dursaff's house, and they're now alienated. And I think he's 18 now. But he was emancipated early. And he testified during the trial, too, and presumably that gave some weight to what might happen in the future if there was another denial of access, because you can look at one of the children and see how harmful it was to that child and perhaps extrapolate from that child what would happen with other children.
How do you tie that incident to the denial of access to the grandparents?
Well, that's what Dr. Otis testified to, and also what Gage testified to, that he felt this disconnect between he and Mr. Dursaff following the denial of access after the mandamus came down in the Supreme Court. So we tie it based on his own statement and Dr. Otis's statements as well.
But don't we have to look at each of the children individually? I mean, can we really say just because Gage felt that
no.
way?
Yes, I completely agree. And Dr. Otis did look at each of the children individually, which is why he was saying that there is a significant risk with regards to Andrew, and that the risk with regards to Jenna is not as significant, but is still a risk. We do have to look at all the children individually, but you can at least tell what kind of environment it is that the children are living in and what it is that they endure when they're cut off from their grandparents by seeing how it's affected other children in the same household. That's not to say that all children will, that the other two kids, if there's a denial of access, will, divorce their dad. That it doesn't necessarily mean that, but it does show, or it does tend to show, or preponderates towards a finding that that same harm would be visited upon the other children. The third central theme of Mr. Dursaff's oral argument is that the kids are doing fine, that they're involved in extracurricular activities, and they go hunting and play video games. And I'm out of time, so thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Orson. And, Mr. Michelle, do you have rebuttal?
I apologize?
Do you have rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor.
Refresh our memory of the age.
I believe now they are 9 and 13.
Able to communicate their desire.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's outside the record, so I won't talk about it, but yes, they are.
Mr. Michelle, are
yes.
there any cases dealing with a prospective denial of access and a prospective substantial impairment?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe we cited those in our cases, this court and the Eastland Court of Appeals, where they denied, there was no evidence of denial of visitation, and that was it. Case
so
over.
You're just saying a prospective denial deprives the grandparents of standing, or a prospective denial is insufficient to show substantial impairment, or...
Yes, I think in my opinion, to be a standing element. My alternative position in this court is that it is an express element that they must meet. And the funnel of that starts with, obviously, Troxell, in Troxell about there being no denial. As the court may or may not know, I was the attorney who handled Mays Hooper, handled Dursoff, and I've handled Champliss, three cases the court has relied on in rendering this recent opinion. All three times we prevailed on those. Troxell, and I was involved in the legislature amendment of this statute, and that was an adoption of Troxell into the code to make it meet constitutional muster. Nobody ever discussed about a possible prospective denial in the future. Clearly, if you did that, every grandparent could say, I think he's going to cut me off. It's so hypothetical. How can you defend? It's like chasing windmills. And I disagree. It said the statute to me clearly means if there's a denial, and it uses like the word, sometimes the word may can mean shall when it's used in its language under the attorney's fees award. It's when the trial court, the party may be awarded attorney's fees. That means a command. In this case, the Eastland Court, and I believe this court, has and Troxell have all looked to constitutional ramifications giving this grandparent standing to come in to open the door saying, hey, I've been cut off, and that's going to hurt the kid. That's the fallacy in Dr. Otis's opinion. You heard it. He quoted directly out of the record. If visitation is not restored, Dr. Otis had so little understanding of this case, he didn't know visitation was going on. They quote Andrew crying when he sees Dr. Otis. I can read real easily into that. He was shot. He goes, oh, we're having another fight. Ricky Dursoff was sued in 2003 by Connie Johnson, and she took his kids away from him saying he had abused his children. He's been fighting these people for 7 years to raise his children. If this court opens the door because they're financially able to money whip him over these years, Ricky's just not going to give up, and he's got lawyers who are willing to fight for him. But Dr. Otis didn't even understand. Andrew cried at the first visit and the first evaluation 5 years ago. and it wasn't significantly impairing him. You read the record, he goes, he walks up there, you can almost see from his testimony, Dr. Otis, he's surprised that he's having to go through this again. The second visit Andrew had with Dr. Otis, he was fine. The court cannot possibly adopt that standard about prospective denial, because that would mean it make it would render it meaningless.
Well, what do you do with the word would?
I think you have to read it. It's granted, it's not very nicely worded, but it says if there's evidence that the denial would significantly impair. I read that as a passive verb, to meaning past tensed. I know it's not greatly, but it says the denial of possession or access to the child would significantly impair. What the cases have held and what the Supreme Court has indicated for constitutional muster is that there has got to be some denial. With regard to the specific quote on Jenna, I'm sorry, I'm going to try to hit these really quickly. Page 14, the question is, could her well-being? That doesn't meet any standards that I'm aware of. I think there's, first of all, the question's could. Then he said there's some probability, but much less so. That constitutes absolutely, I think it's completely speculative. What's it based on? Two interviews?
He was not their guardian ad litem.
He wasn't their guardian ad litem. He wasn't their counselor. He hadn't seen these kids in 4 years. He sees them for two visits and says, oh, if he doesn't see grandma, that's going to ruin his life. I mean, it's an impossible opinion. The court totally ignored all of the on-hands people, Ricky every day, the friends, the Bookers, Tammy Durzoff, the people who see these kids every day. Where were the teachers? Where were the medical providers? Where were the counselors to say one iota of harm? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Thank you, Mr. Orsinger. And we appreciate your arguments. Your case is submitted, and we will adjourn for the day. You're excused.
All rise.